Gene Cernan, let's bring our Voice of America audience up to date on you and your history with NASA. When did you come into this space program?
I came into the program, I actually was selected in October of 1963 and really came to work in January 1964. So I'm going on 5.5 years right now.
And just a bit about your background, too. You're originally from the state of Illinois, correct?
Right. I was actually born in Chicago and lived in the suburban area of Chicago and went to school in the western suburbs, Maywood, Illinois. Then went to Purdue University, received my Bachelor of Science degree in Electrical Engineering, and then from there into Navy flight training, where I became a naval aviator, and here I am. There's a lot happened in between that time, but here I am.
You went from the Navy as a flyer of jet aircraft to NASA as an astronaut.
Right. I was in operational flying, most of it off of, all of it off of carriers, and particularly in the Far East, and then I actually was selected for the program, the NASA program, while I was in Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, working on my master's degree in aeronautical engineering.
And tell us a bit about your family.
Well, I've got, I think, a pretty nice one, Rhett. You being a personal friend of mine, I think you'll agree with me, but I've got a wife who used to fly for Continental Airlines, and I've got a little daughter,
Barbara,
and I've got only one child, a 6-year-old little girl, Teresa Dawn, and we call her Tracy.
I understand you have a whole bunch of new Snoopies.
Yeah, we've got a little dog, a Cocker Spaniel, who's 2 years old, and we call her Venus. Really, when we named her, it didn't have any particular aspect or association with the space program, but we thought it was a name. We had a dog when we first got married named Venus. And as of 6 o'clock this morning, we've got four more little dogs. We got four little Snoopies, little blonde Cocker Spaniel pups. So we had a long night last night.
In your neighborhood, in this area, what amount of time have you when you're not on a spaceflight for social activity? What I'm getting at is you work very hard. When you're on a crew assignment, you have very little time at home. Tell us what the life of an astronaut with his family is like.
Well, you're right, Rhett. You really do have very little time at home with your family, especially when you're on a crew. I came home last evening about 7 o'clock, and I'll have to leave Sunday afternoon to go back to the Cape. I'll be there all week, and we'll be home. I'll be home one more day before the flight on May 18th. And this weekend type thing is continuous. And the thing about it, when you come home on a Friday night or Saturday morning, we have been generally putting in till about 4 or 5 or 6 o'clock on Saturday. So by the time you go to church and sit down in the afternoon, it's time to go back to generally the Cape or wherever else you might have to go, so you don't really get too much time. There's always ample opportunity to go out places in the evening and go to dinner or see friends, and Barbara and I enjoy people, and we do a lot of this, but every once in a while you'd just like to say, you know, the heck with it, I'm just going to stay home and I'm not going to do anything. You find yourself doing some things around the house maybe, but you're not going to do anything. And in recent weeks, as the time goes by so very fast, and these 5 years have gone by very fast, and as the flight is approaching, you find out how little time you really have with your family, and you see your children grow up so very rapidly, and you wonder, you're really sort of unfair by not spending more time with them.
I don't think you would exchange occupations with anybody on Earth, though.
No, this is too fantastic of an opportunity. I think certainly my wife appreciates this, and that's what makes it compatible. She understands what I enjoy doing, and I wouldn't be doing anything else but what I'm doing.
Gene Cernan, I believe you are of Czechoslovakian descent. Would you have anything to comment on your background and on your relatives still there and on the people in Czechoslovakia?
Yes, My grandparents on both my mother's side and my father's side were born in Europe, in Czechoslovakia. I'm very much interested as to their background because their background is my background, and of course up until this time I have had very little opportunity to really look into the background and sort of my historical background. I do have relatives over there, relatives who I only know by name and by letter. But I really don't know personally, and I'm looking forward someday to having the opportunity to meeting these people, meeting people in a town where my grandparents maybe grew up, and just sort of expressing to them that I'm very proud to be an American, but American is made up of Czechoslovakians and Germans and Italians and people from all descents, and as a result, I'm very proud to be a Czechoslovakian, too.
Thank you very much, Gene Cernan, Lunar Module Pilot on Apollo 10.
Thank you, Rhett.
Okay, squib one. Now, squib two on, summarize sort of tightly for me your overall role as Lunar Module Pilot. I'll just give you a start and do it in a minute or so.
Okay.
Go as far as you want it. Gene, you are called the Lunar Module Pilot. Would you describe for our listeners what this role entails, your overall mission throughout this flight?
Well, the Lunar Module Pilot is sort of a name tag. It's not really too descriptive because I'm also one of the three command module pilots. And I might just well start with the command module because that's where we all start when we lift off. And I'm really responsible for most all of the systems in the command module. All of the systems, the electrical systems, the propulsion systems, the environmental control systems. By responsible, I mean I am the one who has to monitor them, basically who has to troubleshoot any problems. This does not mean that John Young nor Tom Stafford don't also have to do this and don't also have to be acquainted with the vehicle, but we're all acquainted with the vehicle to a certain extent, and then we have to some degree specialize because of the time we have to train. Now, in addition, Tom Stafford and myself will then go into the lunar module after we get in lunar orbit for the descent. And in our case, the descent down to 10 miles, 8 to 10 miles, and the subsequent rendezvous back to the command module.
That's down a little lower than 15 kilometers, I believe.
That's right. Just a little bit lower and quite a bit faster than anyone ever has been at that altitude before. So I'm responsible then also for being able to fly and understand and troubleshoot and handle the systems on the lunar module as well. So we've really, having two spacecrafts on this flight, it requires a great deal of more emphasis and knowing, a great deal of more energy and being able to fly two spacecraft, which we've tried to make similar, but by the nature of the requirements of their mission, they cannot be similar. So. You don't really get them confused because you always know where you are, but it really requires a lot of midnight oil at times.
When you're in the lunar module, what is your principal role there during that descent and return to rendezvous?
Well, in the lunar module, I've got responsibility primarily for handling all the, as I mentioned earlier, all the systems, turning on and off the coolant valves and the batteries and all these things. In addition, I'm monitoring and handling two computers, one totally on my own, which we call an abort guidance computer, which is actually working independent from our primary guidance and navigation system. Now, I have to sort of program this computer. I have to ask it for the right answers or ask it the right questions and get the right answers, and I have to monitor what it tells me to make sure it's right. And in addition, I'm sort of don't know how to type, but you sure learn how to use your fingers using these computers. On the left hand, I've got another computer, which I use in conjunction with Colonel Stafford. Again, using it to find out what we have to do and when, and to help us guide and navigate and program our spacecraft to be able to do the job that we're trying to do with it. So with that in mind, and there's a lot of other little things, you're monitoring gauges during some of the critical periods. And in addition, we're trying to get some very good strip photography at probably one of the most critical times in a mission, a time when we're the lowest, the closest to the surface, the time when we're going the most rapid, and a time that we're coincidentally enough coming over the most interesting terrain, the ultimate landing sites for our follow-on Apollo mission. So in addition to doing this computer type thing with both hands and trying to monitor and write down a lot of the projected answers, I'm hoping to be able to get some good photography, some good what we call oblique photography of these landing sites, which we hope we might be on one of come July.
Thank you very much, Gene Cernan. Let's hold, stop for a minute if you want to. Are we running close?
Yep, we're almost done.
You want me to talk faster or something?
No, I really want to speak.
I'm sorry.
Remember all of this. This today, yeah. Tonight stuff. We're gonna have to clip.
Okay.
Because all of this stuff is in the can for use during the flight. Everybody. In other words.
All
I'm
right.
Asking you questions.
Okay. Okay. I won't time tag it.
Yeah.
I won't time tag it.
Because we're gonna use these in real time during.
I won't time tag it.
At these period, when I'm talking to you, say about lunar orbit period, the tape with you will run while you're in our respective.
Okay.
Shows, while you're there.
In there. Okay.
But with a little
very
bit
good.
Of
okay. Very
it's
good.
Right here.
Very good. I'll.
All right. Let's see. You remember what I was asking about last night? What do you want to do? What do you think is important for the world?
You know, to be honest with you, when the advent of those puppies came, I didn't have a chance to think about much of anything. But you know, I.
Okay.
I guess if you want to go into some of the aspects of.
Reflect a little if you feel like it.
Okay, if you can give me a leading question of some sort, I'll try and answer it.
Okay. You ready? You want a clapper? Gene, you've been in the space program for some 5 years now. You flew successfully in Gemini 9. You've experienced many things. How do you look back over these 5 years of your career, and what sort of things do they cause you to think about, and what challenges do they offer you?
Well, of course, just the challenge of being part of what I call one of the greatest things to ever happen to mankind, just being part of the space program, has really made this 5 years probably most worthwhile 5 years of my life. Because I feel very strongly and very deeply about, without going into the details of why man, and not necessarily just this country, because space is too big for a person. For instance, space belongs to a world, and when you get out there 250,000 miles away, you're not looking particularly at a person or a race or a country or a nationality. You're looking at a world. And it really, I know, I've been up there, but I've only been as high as 200 miles. When I get to be out there to 240,000 miles, I think you'll be able to look at the world as a pretty insignificant little object in this infinity of space and infinity of time. And you can dwell philosophically on aspects of space flight and why you're going. But, you know, I think when people lose the ambition to reach out, and people lose the ambition to progress, and people lose the ambition to find out what their background is, whether it be their local family background or whether it be the background of humanity, then our world will die. People will die. People will stagnate. And I think the challenge of the space program is going to go on for many, many generations. And I am one to believe that when you talk about an infinity of space and time, there's an infinity of places and an infinity of distance we can reach out and to make this world as we know it a better world to live. I think it's the things that we cannot conceive, the things that we don't really understand, which are eventually going to be the things that really benefit mankind as we know it here on Earth today.
As an engineer, as a pilot, you can very often get carried deeply into the future of science, technology. Do you ever find any real conflict with the more basic human needs right here on Earth? Do you see any problems in your own mind philosophically there?
No, I think people are always going to have human needs, but I think historically, if a country or a nation or a humanity, a mankind, ever turns its back on the opportunity of challenging the unknown to simply try and solve the needs that it has here in this local environment, in Earth, if we want to look at it that way, then it's sowing the seeds of its own destruction. I really sincerely believe that. And I'm just like any average individual, a religious person, and you can go out into space and try and solve some of the problems scientifically, and hopefully step by step we will get these problems solved scientifically. But always there's one more step, and always there's one more step unanswered. And I think when you think about the vastness of outer space and the infinity of space, that it makes one more a believer in the fact that there is some supreme being, whether it be good Buddha or Christ or whatever God it may be that you worship, the satisfying thing, I believe, in one's life is the fact that that one more step that you cannot explain is explained by the belief of some God.
And you're willing to lay your life on the line in order to advance man into this unknown.
That's right. I think I'm just part of a generation that has an opportunity to just barely begin to scrape the surface of learning a little bit more. I believe that things are out there to be known, and the stars and the planets and the things that we'll learn in traversing the distance between the stars and the planet is information that's there to be known. And I'm certainly not one to turn my back on it. And thank God that if I were, there'd be someone to take my place, because people in this country and in this world cannot turn down a challenge, cannot turn down an opportunity. It's not just an opportunity for glamour and it's an adventure, but it's an opportunity to accept a challenge and see what you as an individual, as a group, as a team, as a nation, and I think certainly someday as a world, can really, whether you can really meet this challenge.
Thank you very much, Gene Cernan. Also, let's regroup.
I don't know whether that's the type of thing you want read or not.
Now, on the, now you touched, you got into, Doug, how am I doing on you? Whenever we start on me, whenever we start the clock on me, how am I doing? Okay.
6 minutes, 32 seconds, and 29 mil.
On the lunar orbit, I want to get back some more on you. On the lunar orbit here, you ran two things together.
Okay.
One was the instruments, and you started talking about the strip photography.
Okay.
Let's see if we can get a just from a little different angle. What you're up to during that low pass? Now, are you mostly a photographer? In this time plan, when you turn it over, start looking down at all these.
Well, there's periods. There's a period where yes, that's true. But we're still preparing, having to prepare and program computers for the burn that comes right after the lunar landing pass.
Okay.
So if you get behind, right, you blow your whole rendezvous, and so really your life is involved to some extent besides the photography type of thing. So you've got to make the burn.
Okay, let's just run through this time sequence of, say, the 800 seconds.
Fine.
All right, rolling. Tell me when we're going. Say when. I think the most exciting thing to come out of Apollo 10, and probably one of the most exciting experiences that any man will ever see, will be that thing that you and Tom Stafford will be looking at during the 800 seconds that you pass close to the surface of the moon, within some 15 kilometers. Let's go through and summarize your activities, Gene.
Well, I believe visually that when you come down on the first time from 60 miles, and certainly the second time when you come from behind the moon from 200 miles high, that it... there's going to be some question in your mind whether it's going to be 10 miles or 8 miles or 0 miles, because I'm sure it's going to visually look like you're well, we're coming down very rapidly, and we're going faster than man has ever traveled at that altitude above any object, some 5,500 feet per second. I'm not sure what that would convert to in meters, but it's quite fast, and it's faster. It's about 9 times the speed of sound is what it is. And We're very busy because we've got a landing radar test. We're preparing, we're doing this primarily to get information for the landing mission, which will follow. We're doing a landing radar test. We're taking a great deal of strip photography pictures, oblique pictures of the actual landing sites, the first and second landing site that we have listed to land at in follow-on Apollo missions. We're actually taking pictures so that the follow-on crews can then be able to know what to look at and when to look at it. But in addition to taking a picture, I'm working with two computers, because they have to be programmed now to handle this landing radar test to get information there. We have to prepare to do a phasing burn short minutes after this pass over the landing site, because if we don't, it affects our whole rendezvous, and if you don't get back, it could really spoil your whole day. So it, oddly enough, and as things in this program go, the most important period is generally the time which you have the most important things to do and is the most crowded. If you could spread out these things over a longer period of time, it'd be all right, but we're only over that low landing site pass on two separate occasions and under different circumstances, and each time there are probably many more things that we have to do than you would really like to have to do at that time.
We'll be hearing much communication from you, though, won't we, during that period?
I don't know how talkative I'll be, but I'm sure I'm going to have a lot to say when we're passing over about 8 miles over that lunar surface, because I get the feeling right now, I don't know, but I can project to that point, and I think we'll feel like we're flying right down in some of those craters at that altitude. And we fly at that altitude every day in our airplanes. We fly at 40 and 50,000 feet almost every day, so we're familiar with that altitude. I believe the horizon is going to look like it's wrapped over the top of us. It's going to look very exciting without question. And the only problem is it's going to go by so fast, and we cannot afford to miss anything. So we're really not going to be able to just stand there and enjoy it.
Thanks very much, Gene. We'll be listening.
Thank you, Red.
Okay. Anybody else have anything for a wrap-up spot with Gene? And if I left out anything that anybody wanted with Gene at this point, we've got about 2 minutes. I thought I would hit Tom with that.
There is one other advantage to the fact that you touched on the business that most of us have flown an aircraft, and we know the size of a highway. And the fact that you don't know that in the moment, you never really can be sure perceptively.
That's right.
All right. You say you have flown over highways over the Earth at comparable distances to that to which you will descend while orbiting the Moon, and yet you know how large a highway is, you know how large that wheat field is below you. How do you think you can perceive the size of objects and the true dimensions of craters while you're whizzing past the Moon so fast?
Well, this is one of the problems. We have purposely flown. Of course, we fly most of the time at 40, 45,000 feet, so we get a feel for how wide a runway is or how wide a highway is. But we have a reference point on Earth. On the Moon, you really don't have a reference point. You look at a crater, and you don't know really how big it is. So what we're attempting to do is familiarize ourselves, give ourselves some visual dimensional perception to be able to say, gee, I know I'm at 8 miles above the ground, and I know that when I've flown in airplanes before at that altitude, that crater or that boulder, we hope to be able to see some boulders, is about the width of a runway or is about the size of a house, which you can see from those altitudes. Once we establish that type of perception, I think we'll be able to tell you exactly, and certainly with the film we bring back, exactly the size of object we're able to resolve with the naked eye. The problem is, a nice thing, if there was a runway or a house or something or a city block on the Moon, then you could relate everything in size to that. We're hoping, as a side note, to be able to see one of our surveyor spacecraft that is sitting on the Moon right now. And if the sun gives us a right reflection off the spacecraft, we're going to be looking for it, and we may just be able to see it. I think the sight is going to be fantastic, and we... won't be able to share it with you visually, but we certainly hope through some words that we'll be able to share that moment or those moments verbally and descriptively with people throughout the world.
Thanks very much, Gene Cernan. Okay.
Okay.
Wait a minute. He's got something. What was it, Farmer?
That's right.
Silent shot? Okay, we can cut my tape.
Yeah.
This question of perceptive, that you're going to have.
Just a chair. Yeah.